My friends, welcome to episode number 22 of Material Issues with Mark Hirschberger of Pop Detective Records and my good friend, Mr. David Bash of the International Pop Overthrow Festival, soon to be at Arlene Grocery in New York. We are looking forward to that. If I can get out of the house enough, I'm going to head up to New York myself because I'm just a stone's throw away. David, how are you feeling tonight?
I'm feeling great, Mark. How are you?
Oh, fantastic. Good day, sunshine. It's a great day to be alive, breathing the air and hanging here with my good friend and talking music and talking stuff. So hopefully,
yeah, it really is a great day. We are waiting for our guest, the esteemed Todd Taylor, to arrive. We have sent him the link, but have not heard back, so we'll just bide our time watching Scotty grow while we're...
Yeah. Hey, that's, I can't do it. That was almost too easy of a setup. Right. But yeah, I mean, sometimes connections, because he is in the UK. He's far away. If he pops up into the queue, we'll bring him in, and hopefully that will happen in the very near future. As we're broadcasting, but if not, David and I always like to talk about some music and some things. One thing that I want to talk about, and I know David's a fan because we both enjoy what we wear on our wrists, but just in the mail today, and if you go to my YouTube channel, you can see an unboxing video.
Oh, wow.
I did a 5-minute unboxing. I never did an unboxing before. So I did it, and it's right here on my wrist. It's hard to see with the light, but it is the Chicago-based company Wolf Point. It's their moon phase watch called White Moon.
And it's really beautiful, Mark.
As
many of you know, I'm a big watch collector. I probably have about 40 watches currently. Yeah. I had been eyeing some Wolf Points. I haven't gotten around to buying one yet, but they're very affordable, and it is a Chicago-based company. So if you're in the U.S., you will be supporting a U.S. business by buying it. And yeah, they have some really nice designs. So
they really do. This limited edition Moon Phase watch, they had like three versions. One had an orange face. One had a blue face. I went with the white one because you can really it's hard to see here with this light, but the dial, the number really pops. And I liked it a lot. And I'll tell you what, it's a perfect weight. It's a perfect millimeter. Everything about it is just really comfortable. So I told Wolf Point to tune into Material Issues tonight. So if they're tuning in, yeah, Wolf Point, David and I can use further discounts.
Absolutely. No, it's a good purchase.
It's a great watch.
I have my Accutron 60th anniversary limited. Well, it's not limited, but 60th anniversary Space View, which is my favorite watch right now. Nice. There's a huge history behind it, which I won't get into at the moment.
How's the one?
What are you wearing, Andy? That's what we need. I got a few other favorites sitting right here. We've got the... I'm so disoriented. Frederick Constantin World Time Watch, which tells you the time in different cities around the world. It's got a beautiful design another big favorite. Let's see what else we got here. The Mont Blanc salmon color dial. This is probably the best salmon color dial I've ever seen. And I love Mont Blanc pens.
It's a tasty watch too. I think it's just
it's a good one. It's very very retro. It reminds me of something that Don Draper would wear, Mad Men. That would go very well with his attire. This is the Fairer Crooms. It's burgundy. I don't know if the burgundy is shining through well here right now. But it's an amazing color, especially in the sunlight. It's just breathtaking.
Mm.
The replica Soviet cup. No, it is not. Sorry, Andy.
I've got my special. Hey, we do have somebody in the queue that's going to join us momentarily.
Oh, is he there?
Yeah, Tot came in. Well, Tot will be right with you, my friend. I've got my special XTC 25 o'clock watch. It's, you know, it's in military time, and it does go to 25 o'clock. It's pretty confusing because I'm always an hour ahead of time.
If you really had that, I would want to know because I would be all over it. I'd be buying it in a second.
Wouldn't that be cool if it went to 25 o'clock?
It would be amazing.
Andy Partridge, if you're watching, we can work a deal with my idea. It's all good.
But, sure, why not?
Yeah, indeed, David. Nice to see Tot pop into the queue. We're going to bring him on here momentarily, but love talking watches. We should do a whole watch episode.
I would be all over that. Yes.
I don't know how many fans of the show would dump us left and right, but I mean, watches are a beautiful
95%
thing.
95% of them would. But that's their loss.
Very good.
All right. One last one before we introduce Todd. This is a company called Aragon. They make very inexpensive watches, and I know it's not showing up well, but this is a really deep purple color. It looks kind of blue on the screen, but it's just, again, another one that just absolutely bursts when you put it in sunlight. The guy who designs the watches, Wing Lang, is a Facebook friend. And,
nice.
He designs lots of really cool stuff. I mean, it seems like every week they're coming out with something else. And I'm going to have to. I love his videos because he's very proud of what he does. He'll say, "This is really awesome," as if someone else did it.
Yeah. You know, but it's him. maybe we'll have to get him, since we know, maybe we have to get him working on the XTC 25 o'clock watch.
If he does that, he's invited to be on Material Issues. But let's introduce our guest, singer, songwriter, author. Been around a while and still going very strong, as his latest album, Frisbee, would attest. He's been in lots of bands throughout from the 70s through now. I've done tons of CDs, written several books, but the story of John Knightley is his first novel, and we want to ask about that. That came out a few years ago. He scored soundtracks. He's done BBC documentaries, all kinds of stuff. This is a true Renaissance man. But we have him here mostly for his music, which we really love. So without further ado, would you please give a huge welcome to Mr. Tot Taylor?
Hello.
There he is.
Hey, Ed. How are you?
Very well, Tot. How are you?
Good, thanks. Not too bad. I managed to download the links and stuff.
Nice. Nice to meet you, Tot. Nice to meet you.
And you. Hello, Mark, and hello, David. How are you?
Excellent.
We're doing well. It's 3 o'clock in LA, and I know you lived out here for a while.
You're
kind of familiar.
Yeah.
It almost looks like you have sunlight coming through, which you obviously
don't. Now
there we go.
Yeah, that's better. Yeah. I did live there in the sort of late 80s up to mid 90s. Yeah, I did a lot of studio work, and I did some sort of crazy publishing things. I did a lot of co-writes, and I organized co-writes and stuff. So I know it a bit. I started off in Koreatown, weirdly enough, but when it wasn't very nice, shall we say. because it was weird, and they had here. I've never seen the supermarket so big. It was like 5 miles of supermarket, you know, whereas we've got like 10 yards of supermarket. So that was exciting in itself. But I had a great time.
What did you think of our portions when you went to restaurants? Were they just way over the top?
They were nuts. Yeah. I like alcohol. And so I was very impressed with the alcohol portions. I was very, very impressed with the cocktails because they were the real kind of Hollywood cocktails.
Yeah, yeah.
We went to all the sort of weird places. But I was organizing. I was doing a favor for a publishing company, Warner Chappell, in a way, in in London to organize something for them so that they could bring some people over to us. And so I went around to see quite a lot of songwriters. And in the morning, I had a couple of people who were looking after me from the publishing company. And they said to me, the first time they met me, they said, what kind of things do you like? And as a joke, I kind of said, oh, you know, a cocktail would be good. They said, that's great, because we always start off with 5 cocktails every day. And we meet at so-and-so. It was a place very close to Chateau Marmont, but I can't remember what it was called. They said, we meet there every day and we have these cocktails. And I had like 2, which was a mistake, and it knocked me for 6, to be honest. Yeah. That was my sort of introduction. But yeah, I loved being out there. Yeah.
Great. Well, if you ever decide to come back, we'll welcome you back with open
arms. Oh, I love it. Well, I will. I hope I will, Mark. I hope so.
Yeah, that'd be nice. That'd be nice. We always, you know, we start off a lot. Todd, you've done so much. You're just looking at your websites and Wikipedias and history and things. You're involved in quite a lot of different avenues, musically, writing, soundtrack work, as an author. We like to go back a lot and talk about the beginning. What was your childhood like as far as musically? Where did music come into your life early on?
Like a lot of people who end up doing music for their career or trying to do music for your career, because it's quite difficult to sustain it as a career. I came from a kind of a line of musical people. Although we lived in the countryside, we lived in East Anglia, near an American air base, a place called Mildenhall. We lived between 2 US air bases, basically, you know, USAF air bases. And that was the source of our music, because the only music that we had otherwise, this would have been in sort of 1960 to 63 or 4, something like that, was when I got interested in music, would have been the records coming from the bay. So in other words, the stuff coming, which was ex jukebox. And my dad had a sweet shop, and some of these records would filter into the sweet shop to be sold. And sometimes, because it was a poor area, it was a farming area known as the Fens, Fenland, near Ely. If you know, there's a Pink Floyd record, because I came from Cambridge, which is like 10 miles down the road, where you can see Ely Cathedral. Yeah. And that was where we were, basically. People would bring in from the air bases, they'd bring in singles, because I hadn't got any money to swap with my dad, and he'd give them some food or 2 loaves of bread or whatever it was. And that was the source of my early records. So 7-inch singles I associated with being music. You know, music comes from them. We didn't have a piano in the house. but I had 6 or 7 aunts, and they were all church organists.
Wow.
Yeah.
So then we start to get into this thing where, because we had big family on both sides, in 1960, there was an offer from the British government that if you couldn't support your family, if your family couldn't support itself, they would pay for you to go to Australia, to emigrate to Australia. And so half of our family wrapped up. They gave each person, this is going to sound crazy as well, but you know, they gave each individual £10 and put them on a boat to Australia.
Oh, Lord. Yeah.
1960, you know, to seek their fortune. And so my family, half of it went, and we never saw them again. So that
£10 went pretty far, apparently.
Yeah.
A long way. But that is how I got into recording, because... you know, it would have been much, much too expensive. We never expected to see them again, and they never expected to see us again. It was one of these things where your grandmother's rushing down the street following the car when they're leaving, you know, don't go, this is all crazy and all this stuff. It was a real sort of family tragedy. You know, at every Christmas, my uncle who'd gone, who was kind of technical, he was an electrician, he bought a tape machine a 7-inch little tape machine, and he recorded a Christmas message of every one of them and their friends and their new neighbors and their new friends speaking to us and say, hello, everybody in England. This is so-and-so, and we're in the so-and-so. We're sitting in the garage. We bought this tape recorder. So this little 7-inch tape, 3 3/4, came to us. And of course, we put it on and we listened to it. And it was them saying, hello, everybody. And then we had to record over it and send it back.
Wow.
And that was how I learned to record something, and the magical fact that something could be recorded. Now, about 2 or 3 years down the line, when I would have been about 8 or 9, maybe, the tape that came had like 4 tracks on it. And we had a new tape machine which ran 4 tracks. There was only a 2-track tape machine, but you could put it between the heads and you get like these extra tracks. And at that point, I realized that, you know, while we were talking, I could press record, and that would multi-track or overdub on to them. And then I thought, wow. You know, without going into it anymore, that was how I got into recording. Yeah, Australia.
Now, you're all the aunts that played with church organ music, is that where you learned keyboards from the aunts, or how were you taught? Were you trained by anybody, or were you more picking it by ear and learning it yourself?
I wasn't trained by anyone, Mark. No, I don't think I could be trained. I don't read music, even though a lot of the music I play is quite complex harmonically. Yes. And I probably always listened to more classical music than pop music, if you want to, you know, just call them those two things. Of course, everything's connected. Pop music is classical music. I went to see my Aunt Beatrice one afternoon, and she was one of the church organists, and somebody wasn't very well in the family. Again, this would be about the same time, probably would be about 7 or 8 years old. To go to see somebody, you'd have to travel 20 miles because we lived in the Fenlands, flatlands. We lived right next to the Duke of Edinburgh's bird reserve. There was a kind of a bird reserve which Prince Charles had something to do with it, and a guy called Peter Scott, who was a sort of a leading guy. And we lived in this marshland place, and I went to her house to see her and her son one day, and there was the piano, which I didn't really know anything about, except I'd seen people playing it on TV and being fascinated by it. But she sat down and saw that I was looking at it and was, you know, sort of mesmerized by it, I guess. And she said, you know, hey, look, you know, you can put your finger on there and it makes a noise. And she just put my finger on it and went, dang. And then she sat down and played a little hymn. And I saw her fingers moving. And I simply thought to myself, when she moves in the direction right, the note goes up. And when she moves in the direction down, the note goes down. So when I followed the tune, which was one of these like, da 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 da, you know, it was one of those, kind of like a Methodist hymn. And I literally just mapped her finger, put my finger on, and just went down, down, da 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 da. And she went, whoa, what's happening? And I said, I don't know. And at that point, I started to kind of float. So that was where it started.
Wow. Well,
were you listening to pirate radio stations?
That's a very, very good point and a good cue, Mark, because I should have. Yeah, I could have gone straight away onto that. So because we're in East, you know which bit that is, don't you? You've got like where Cambridge is, and then you sort of turn right, and you've got about 60 miles before you hit the coast. And when you hit the coast, you are about 2 miles from where the pirate radio stations were parked. So Radio London was the one, actually, that we listened to most of all. But, of course, Luxembourg was down there as well. And there's about 4 or 5 of them. So, again, because of the geographical area that I was in, it was much easier for me to pick up pop music that wasn't the BBC than it would have been if I'd lived in Wales or Scotland or whatever. So, yeah, we had the pirates. They were all influential. You were just listening to it every day. It was like a circus. And if you think about the kind of music, if I move on to sort of, you know, 1965, 66, 67, before it got more orchestral. To my little brain, you know, that was the music that really, really excited me. I remember first hearing as well, She Loves You. That's a very basic thing to say, but I remember the first time I heard it, and I understood that every time they sang the chorus, She Loves You, yeah, 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 She Loves You, yeah, yeah, I realized that was a repeat, repeat, repeat. But what my little brain was also connecting was that every time the new repeat came, the chord slid away slightly, and then the chord slid away again. So you got like, She Loves You, yeah, 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 da-da-na-na-na-na, da-da-na-na, and I heard that.
Right.
So I then, you know, we had a piano, I could then go in and kind of go, I think it's that, I think it's that. And because you never knew when you were going to hear the song again, I used to go up to my bedroom and just sing the Beatles songs over and over and over again in my mind, laying on my bed, just because it was the only way of me kind of remembering it. So, yeah, and that was because of the Pirates, because Pirates played all the sort of psychedelic records and all the slightly out there records, the heavier records, which the BBC wouldn't play. Although right. The BBC did play a lot of them, you know, the BBC was incredible at that point, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And then when did you get into your first band?
The first thing that I could easily get into, because I didn't have an electric guitar, I had a little acoustic guitar, a £10 guitar that my dad had bought me, and I'd sort of badgered him for a bit, but they were very supportive, and anything you wanted basically you'd get. I was probably about 9 or 10, and I joined this little folk group, you know, where we were 5 miles from Ely, E-L-Y, if people are not familiar with that. So named because they have a lot of eels there. You've got to remember, we're living in water. It's called waterland. You know, the Fenlands is drained water. When Nicholas Vermeyden came from Holland 200 years before and drained the fens by building dikes, so that people could use that for agriculture. And that was exactly right. Where we lived. We lived in the middle of nowhere in the drained fields. So it was, you know, there was a lot of flies everywhere. You know, there's a lot of insects, there were frogs all over the place. And God knows, because the animal culture or insect culture still carried on, even though the thing had been drained. How did I get onto that? I can't remember what you said now.
I had you about joining your first band.
You're talking 9 or 10 years old with a folk group.
Oh, that's right. Sorry about that. Yeah. So that was right. So the only thing that was close to us was a folk club, which was in an old tea room place. And I joined this little group where you could go up there and play the song. And I played Catch a Falling Star. And put it in your pocket.
Put it in your pocket, yeah.
Yeah. Soon after that, maybe a year after that, I joined another little group, and we then supported, this would be something that people would know, we supported Martin Carthy.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And that was when I watched his incredible finger picking, like mesmerized by it, really just stood right in front of him, and I thought, I wonder if I could do it. And my brain recorded this bonk up bonk up bonk up bonk up bonk up bonk up bonk, that thing, you know, my brain recorded that, and I went home and practiced it, and probably within a week or two, I mean, I was not playing like Martin Carthy. he was a master, an absolute sort of, it's so precise, but at least I could work the mechanicals of it, you know, and then started to translate that to the piano and make a bit of progress there.
What was more natural for you, playing the piano because you don't read music, or picking through the guitar?
Both were fine, and I've always stuck with that. Then I started to play. My dad bought me a drum kit, so then I started to, you know. But what then became more important to me was that it was not going to be as easy as I thought playing instruments, because I'm left-handed. And so number one, I originally learned the guitar backwards. In other words, the low string was on the bottom. Mm-hmm. I was hitting that with my finger as the bass note, and my thumb was hitting the top melody string, kind of, so the E and the B, until a friend of mine came down to see me one day and said, you know, I've sussed it. You got to change those strings around, you know. So I played 2 or 3 years upside down, basically, still pointing in this direction, in other words, to the right from the left, which is the left-handed direction. But I'd been placed number 31 out of 31 children at school because I was left-handed, because the left-handers were dunces.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, that's what it suited me, because I'll tell you where number 31 in the class was, right at the bloody back.
All right.
You could easily sit there like this with your left hand, you know, writing something on the desk, and you could lodge your other hand on your, and you could literally sit there like this.
And nobody knew wiser.
No, for 40 minutes. And that was what I did. I sat there for 40 minutes and I daydreamed through every single class. I hated school, detested it. It had nothing to do with education whatsoever. Yeah. And being left-handed at school was a problem.
And how early on was it when you started writing or trying to write your own things or you go down that road?
Well, weirdly enough, I think the idea of writing a song or writing poems, you know, all kids write poems, don't they? Verses, you have a line, you put it there, and somebody tells you that you can rhyme it on the last word of the line with something. And that feels like a magical thing as well. And it did to me. So my early songs were derived from these little 8-line poems that I now realize, I didn't know they had 8 lines, but I had a look back through them because I moved about 2 years ago and found all my old books and stuff. And my early songs derived from that. And I realized reading those pretty crazy little bits of poetry, little bits of verse, that the rhythm in the verses, in the poems, were the tune was almost there. So if you kind of like, you know, had a like da 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 da, or as a tune, you know, da 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 da, I already had the, you know, he was never a smoking man, or whatever the hell you want to put to it, you know.
Right,
but
right.
I already had, so that's why he was never a smoking man. Example. Now you take the melody away and you put it back. I could go da 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 da, or I could go da 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 da, or I could go da 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 da. You see, so the rhythm of my words always suggested a melody, and I think that's really how it started. I'd say by the time I was like 10, 11, I had quite a lot of poems. I had a few books of poems, in fact. Not very long, though. I'd have like 2 stanzas. And then I'd kind of dump it. I don't know. It's just interesting looking at it now.
Yeah.
You know, I have no idea why my, you know, 10 or 11 year mind did that. I don't know.
Take us a little bit further now to a special moment. You guys got signed to Island. It seems like back then, you know, good bands got signed. How did that happen?
Well, we were very, very young. I was 15, actually, when that all came about. The group came about. It was a group from school. Before, this was about 71, 72 into 73. Before punk, which happened in a different way in Britain, as I'm sure you know, I know you know. Before that, there was a kind of a Art Deco period, a sort of what I call a Fred Astaire period. we used to go to cinemas in back streets in Cambridge and watch black and white Fred Astaire films and horror films and Frankenstein and everything. There was definitely a 1930s thing going on, and I particularly was very interested in that because that had been what my mother had always been keen on. She was a dancer, loved dancing and singing, very, very musical. Both my parents were. And she was singing all the songs that Fred Astaire sang. So Irving Berlin, Cole Porter. So when I was listening to, you know, She Loves You, in the background, I'd hear her wandering around the house. You know, I get no kick from champagne. Mere alcohol doesn't thrill me at all. You know, so tell me why, darling, must it be true? I get a kick out of you. You see, so this sort of very shaped architecture of these words being built, like building blocks, that definitely rubbed off on me as well. And so eventually when we'd watched the film maybe twice, the film would come up on TV twice or whatever, maybe three times, because the BBC, if they showed it once, they showed it a couple, you know, three or four times. You'd hear the songs a few times, you'd watch Fred and Ginger, and then you'd something like, say, top hat, you know, I'm putting on my top hat, brushing off my shirt tails, I'm going out tonight, that simply reeks with class, and all that stuff. I thought, wow, this is great. This is very, 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 very rhythmic. Is that me or you?
It's me, and it's gone.
Okay. That's his shoe phone.
That's Fred.
That's Fred.
Yeah, I saw him once actually in LA. He was in the big post office reading writing paper.
That's pretty cool.
I was too scared to go and speak to him. So when I heard this rhythm, you know, and the taps, it's very exciting. So that was just as exciting to me as hearing the Beatles or the Kinks or the Who, which of course I was incredibly excited by as well.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. And you can hear both. You can hear both influences in so much of the music you do, which is great. That because a lot of people who do rock and roll didn't have the background you did, and therefore you don't get that show music element of it. And I love it. Is Let's Socialize ever going to be released?
Yeah,
I want to hear it.
There you go.
Yeah, that's a long story about that, which probably not appropriate to tell now. But basically, We were watching the Old Grey Whistle Test, which was our sort of funky music program, you know, our underground progressive music program. And Richard Williams, the great journalist and writer and everything, was the presenter of that. And to keep it short, our little group from school, which was a special moment, we went to see him. We just showed up at the door of Island Records one day, actually, after finding out the address, and we managed to persuade, well, he came down the stairs, and kind of, we were wearing our Fred Astaire gear, by the way, so this is about 1973, and we had these white suits and the bow ties, and I had an actual stick and a top hat. It's crazy, you know, you've got to get an appointment somehow.
So
we did, and we got signed very quickly.
Amazing.
And we were all about the same age. He listened to the tape, didn't say anything about it. He just said, I like it, you know, and we'll be in touch. So obviously that was more or less the first record company, a meeting we'd ever had. That was the first time we'd ever played anything to anyone. So we didn't know what to expect. So when he said, you know, we'll be in touch, we were all thinking they'll be in touch.
Yeah.
But amazingly they were in touch. And the next morning, when I got home, cause I wasn't supposed to be going to London. It was too far for me to go really. So when I got home, my mother, this was Island Records, where we'd been, obviously, where Richard Williams at the time was the A&R, is the director of A&R. And my mother said to me, how are you? You know, it was about like 8 o'clock at night. I said, yeah, fine. Is everything all right? Yes, yes. Who do you know in Ireland? Ireland. Yeah. Who do you know in Ireland? Because, you know, I hadn't told them that I'd been there. I'd been to London. I said, why? What do you mean? She goes, somebody phoned you from Ireland and you need to phone them back. So I said, So the next morning I phoned the number, and again, you know, to keep it short, they offered us a record deal. And we then spent about 3 or 4 months trying to make a record, having the photos taken, doing all the stuff with... part of it was made with Tony Platt, who was the engineer at Island Studios, one of the engineers at Island Studios at the time. I remember Roxy Music was recording next door, down at Basing Street, which was very, very close. Sparks were in that same studio with her. And also another band called Sharks, which was Chris Spedding and Snip.
Yep.
And a couple of other people went through that band. And we were supposed to be going on tour with them, which never materialized because Ireland realized very quickly that we were too inexperienced. We were too young. We didn't have a clue about anything. You know, we were hicks and sticks, basically. Say, like 6 months down the line, we were much more sophisticated. We'd sorted ourselves out. But they just, dropped us, kind of thing. But we did record these two songs. Let's Socialize is one that you just mentioned. And I've just spent 2 years re-recording and restoring all the songs that I wrote at that period, period. In other words, pre-playtime. My album 1980 Playtime was officially my first album, but I had done two or three albums by myself before that. Let's Socialize was on that. That will be coming out towards the end of next year.
Oh wow. Great. Awesome.
So take us into advertising, because obviously that's what, you know, so many of the rockers know you the most for.
Mm. Well, so so for people who don't know me or people who aren't rockers, advertising started off as a band, which I met a guy from Cambridge, Simon Boswell. And we both wanted to form bands. I was living in West Hampstead. I lived in a flat opposite Bob Harris. I mean, this is like really weird. I was sort of ended up bumping in or listening or being with somebody. He lived in the flat opposite us. And Simon came to do an audition for me one day, and we got on so well and he was really good. And I said, okay, well, you're great. You know, perhaps we should do something together. What do you want to do? And he said, I'll tell you what I've been thinking about. He said, I think that in the future, all pop music will be disposable. And I remember when he said that, I thought, that's wrong. That's I don't think that. So I kind of went, yeah. And he said, yeah, I think it's all going to be disposable. And I think that all pop records in the future are not going to be like 3 minutes or 3.5 minutes long. They're going to be like 1 minute long. So I kind of went, right. So I was thinking, I don't think that at all. But I kind of went, yeah, that's probably, you know, you're right. So he said, yeah, so a bit like adverts. I said, okay. So he said, yeah. And I thought in my mind, I thought, you know, I said to you know, advert I sing. And he kind of went, eh? And I said, yeah, like advert I sing. And he said, what is that? I said, I don't know. You know, you're singing adverts. And he went, that's like just bloody stupid, you know. So they kicked this around for a couple of months. that then became melded down into advertising. We wrote the songs. So the idea was, literally, we just thought, how are we going to get a record deal? You know, we got to do something different. Now, punk had kind of just started. We'd been like there, like right at the start, because I think I saw the Damned's first gig, and you know, we'd been going to the RCA, Royal College of Art, where everybody had played. So, you know, both of us had very much been in the 1976 punk thing before the 77 sort of explosion, and then the Manchester people came down and all that. So, and we thought, there's no point in doing it. It's not really our thing. It's too, you know, frankly, it's too sort of musically basic. I mean, it has to be basic because that's what makes it powerful. But we needed some nice chords and, you know, things. So we sort of said, okay, well, let's go and see a couple of people. We went to see EMI with this idea, advertising. We sing these small things, you know, which are like jingles, on the basis that they would go, that's the worst idea we've ever heard. You better. But they kind of went, how much do you want?
Wow.
Yeah, I think they gave us 150 grand, but something like that. Not in one, you know, not in one handshake. But anyway, we got this deal very, very easily with EMI, and then I think it was Mark Rye who was our A&R man at EMI. I think it was Mark Rye who said to us, you know, with what you're doing, why don't we get a real bubblegum producer? Kind of went, wow, I thought, well, I know a little bit about bubblegum records. What I know is I really don't like them. I know they're well produced and everything, but I thought, I really don't know who produced those things, you know. And he said, because one of the guys over here, Kenny Laguna, who's working for us at the moment, did a lot of things with Ohio Express, and, you know, he was Mr. Blow and all this kind of stuff, you know. And we kind of go, okay, well, that's, you know. Now, just after that, Kenny at the time was recording Earthquake for, I can't remember what label, though, Berserkly, wasn't
Berserkly.
It? Earthquake. Yeah. Berserkly. Yeah. Yeah, he was recording Earthquake, and that was doing well. And after that, of course, he produced I Love Rock and Roll, you know, Joan Jett, one of the sort of big, big, big ones. But, yeah, at the time, he wasn't doing that much. He had a hit in the UK with Steve Gibbons' band, which was a great record. But Kenny Laguna, during recording these, we only recorded four tracks with him, but he taught me and us so much. And that was where we learned how to make records, because he had been at Beach Boys sessions and all this, loads and loads of things, Cazenet's Cats and everything, you know, and he knew everything. And he would, and it was him where you'd sort of sing backing vocals and he'd say, okay, now we need to track it eight times. Yeah. Eight times. Yeah. Eight times. Then we shift that off. We shift that off onto another piece of tape. We run that off. And then you sing the next one eight times. All right. You do that. I'm going to go and get some coffee and have a break. We go, okay, eight times. Though. Eight times, Todd, eight times. We go, okay, eight times, yeah. And then he'd come in and he'd go, okay, now we want to all stand around the mic and do the hand clap, and we're not going to do this, you know, we're going to get bits of board and card and wood, and we're going to slap, and now we're going to slap each other, and then we're going to do this sort of... So you were doing sort of real practical echoes and repeats. You didn't have a lot of gear that could go da, 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 da. So you were making a echo. You see what I mean? A repeat.
Yeah.
He taught us all that stuff. He taught us to do it on our bodies and our you know, if you haven't got enough tracks, then you can do your hand claps on your knees.
Right. That's cool. Yeah. Side.
Double it up, because we didn't have enough tracks. So, and then I saw some photos in the Beatles recording books with John, Paul, and George. They'd taken their trousers off, in fact, and they were, you know. So George Martin knew the same stuff.
right.
Anyway, those sessions, which went on for a couple of months, it was hard as well, because I kind of, like, my brain couldn't get, I'd lost the spontaneity of the thing, you see, by doing the thing 16 times instead of two times.
Right.
I felt that we weren't moving on, and I wasn't really enjoying it very much. In retrospect, I realized that he taught us an enormous amount.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
So that album comes out. It's on EMI, which makes you my hero, because you're on the same label as Kate Bush. So,
she was in the studio with us. So she was 17. I think we were 19 or something. Yeah, I remember her coming in the very, very first time, and being very, very shy. And we met her. She was small, and like 4 weeks later, the record was number one.
Every boy had a crush on her, me included. Yeah. So you start after this. You start the Compact organization. I'll say the UK way, and the correct way. And was that just to put out your own records, or were you really looking at that point to start writing for other people, which you ultimately did?
Well, we're moving from sort of 1971 there, from into punk. 75 was the real beginnings of punk. 76 was the most interesting year. By 77, it had become commercialized and everybody suddenly was a punk, which didn't make any sense. and then Kate Bush and all that... a more theatrical thing came back just after punk. And then that takes us up to sort of 80, 81. And I didn't really know what to do. I mean, the advertising thing, I did the interview with Word in Your Ear about 6 weeks ago, David Hepworth and Mark Allen. And Mark had been on tour with advertising. This is very weird. In Northern Ireland, we went to Ireland, did an Irish tour, and Mark was the journalist for NME who came with us to cover the tour. Mark Allen. And so, you know, I'd known him all these years. We were just reminiscing about this. And after the thing was broadcast, somebody contacted us or put a comment on the thing, and it said that, you know, when advertising played in Dublin at the Point, what Tot alluded to it, but he didn't actually say it, the support band was U2. So yeah, which I knew. And I knew it because I'd done a benefit concert in 1986 with Mary Woods, and I was just doing the sound. It was one of these in the mid 80s. There was a lot of big open air concerts in London because Ken Livingstone was the mayor, and he wanted to do that sort of thing. So U2 were headlining, and Mary was one of the supports. There was a lot of bands on. It was a great couple of days, and I was just checking the mics for them or doing something or trying to move something, and you know, somebody tapped me on my shoulder, and that was Bono. And he, you know, introduced himself very nicely. And he said, you know, we supported you, your band, advertising. He said, are you Todd Taylor? I said, yeah, we supported you in Dublin, blah, blah, blah. And I kind of went, I just didn't know that. That was the first time they were called U2, by the way. And these are all stories, so I'm trying to keep it down. I'm trying to cut it down for you both, so we're not here all night for you.
Yeah,
So basically, we did our sound check in Dublin, and then we went out down to the chip shop for about 2 hours. In the meantime, U2 played their first ever gig.
So there we are. And you're down at the chip shop. I love it.
Yeah, we missed history. Seriously, we were out for about an hour and a half. And because we'd, you know, driven over and had to get on the ferry to get over there. And then somebody put another comment on this Word in Your Ear thing saying that it was another support that night, again, which I was ignorant of. And that had been a band called The Addict, ADDIX. And the lead singer in that band was Kirsty MacColl. So we'd unfortunately missed that as well. I mean, it's crazy because when you're actually working, you know, in the background at gigs and things like you don't actually very often watch the band, you know. But anyway, advertising ended when we did the Blondie tour. We supported Blondie. We must have been getting on pretty good to actually get that gig. And we got airlifted out of Birmingham with Blondie because there was a kind of a riot, obviously to do with Blondie, not to do with us. But we couldn't get out of the building. So Blondie said, wow, you know, you better come in and get in the helicopter and we better get out of here because it was a bit dangerous. And I had a few of those. I had another one. I was quite friendly with Sham 69, weirdly enough. Jimmy, particularly Jimmy. But all of them, they're all really nice. And I did some gigs with them, not too many, a couple, but we had to get off stage one night. We did a thing called Rock Goes to College, I think is what it was, for the BBC. And they phoned me up in the afternoon and said, do you want to come and do some keyboards? We need, you know, it's going to be recorded properly and everything. I said, yeah, of course, come and do it. But there was a mountain of screwdrivers come from the audience because we were moving into a very political period in the UK, and the skinhead, some of the skinhead element started to go to gigs, and whoever it was, they would throw, you know, catapult screwdrivers at the stage.
Wow.
And I think I've only watched once, but I think, I mean, it's really bad, you know, you can take your eye out or anything. And I remember standing on the side of the thing. I was kind of safe because while the screwdrivers were coming past Jimmy Purser as he was singing, he was in a very dangerous position. I was kind of playing like this, you see, so I could actually kind of go whoa and turn my back and face the back, and then all these screwdrivers you know, like doing this, you know, twizzling around. And that was when I thought, I don't really want to play live anymore. So, yeah, so that was the thing that took me into a lot of studio work. And then I thought that what I should really do is I was going to have a go at having a label. And so I liked this idea of compact organization. It was only called that because it was just me. So it's very, very compact, but it was an organization. So you had the two things kind of hitting each other. I met Werner Lint on a train in Stockholm. I was doing some recording in Stockholm. And we decided, well, she told me this idea that she had to make a single, to make a song about Stockholm, which would be like spoken. And we went into Music Works studio for 3 hours and made that single one afternoon. I went to see Jeff Travis, played it to him. Rough Trade were, you know, the really sort of new groovy thing. It just kind of started, but it was already established. Jeff, I had not known in Cambridge, but I'd seen him in Cambridge because he went to Cambridge University. And when there was one really groovy record shop called Red House Records, from the song, obviously, it was tiny. And when I went, I didn't go to school much, but the good thing was that when I got the bus to school, I lived 20 miles from my school, you see, that was a long time getting there and a long time getting back. So I'd hide under the seat when the master came to see, to count the heads. I'd hide under the seat. I'd stay under the seat for the next 10 miles, which was Cambridge. And I'd go straight to Red House Records, get there about 10 o'clock in the morning when they opened. And there was about four booths. And what I would see was every morning that I went in there anyway, I'd see a guy freaking out in the, you know, booth to whatever it was, with his, had a lot of hair, very, very curly hair, wiry hair, and his hair was wedged into the booth. He could barely get his head like comfortable in the booth, you see. And that was Jeff Travis.
Okay.
Yeah, but I didn't know that until we spoke about 2 years ago. I was doing a reading for my book at a festival, and Jeff was there and came, it was very kindly, came to hear me do my, you know, talk and stuff. And we said hello afterwards, and I told him this, and he kind of went, wow, that's nuts, you know, because that was like 1970. So, yeah, so when I saw the Rough Trade records, and I'd been observing that very carefully and had this bad EMI experience, and I was also recording at the time for GTO, which was a very nice little label, part of CBS with Paul.
New Music was on that label, right?
That's right. Yeah. Yep. So at that time I'd had Offbeat, the song had come out, and it was Radio 1 BBC Record of the Week, which was like out of nowhere, weird. Because I didn't know who I was, I hadn't done anything before. But this track, you know, Offbeat, on beat, everywhere a beat, beat again, it's very much like a nursery rhyme, you know, it's got that sort of slappy thing that I was talking about at the start, a rat a tat tat lyric, you know. Again, it was on the radio, you know, daytime and evening, and so they took up the option for the album, and that was how we got to make Playtime, basically. But through a series of sort of bad luck, really, and difficulties, GTO was then sold to CBS. GTO had Heatwave, and so I would go into the office sometimes, Heatwave, you know, Boogie Nights and everything, and mm-hmm. and they were massive, and I would see Rod Temperton, you know, who wrote all the great Michael Jackson stuff. But Rod came from Hull, he's English, obviously. And I would see him in the reception at GTO when I was doing my little pop things, sorting out stuff for Heatwave. And then the big day came maybe a year later when I walked in one day and I saw somebody sitting there. And in my idiocy, I thought it was Duke Ellington. So I was looking at him. He's very, he looked very sort of sedate and beautiful and grand, you know. And I went in to see the A&R person, Paul Kinder, and they were obviously like buzzing in there. And I said to him, who is that? Who's that? Who's in reception? And he went, sitting in reception. I said, yeah, who is it? Quincy Jones. I said, oh, right. So that must have been the day when, or that must have been the period where Quincy Jones, you know, came over, got Rod Temperton and kind of went, hey, we've got this guy, Michael Jackson, and, you know, mm-hmm. and then Rod became the big, 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 great songwriter, you know, of the period. So that all started, that was going on at GTO as well. GTO also had a few other weird acts. They had the Walker Brothers. Mm-hmm. And so the other person that I saw in reception was Scott.
Oh, wow.
And the album that they made was it called No Regrets? I think it was.
Yeah.
The final Walker Brothers record. Yeah, they were making that at the time. So they were sort of hovering around as well. So GTO, Jem Toby organization, a very interesting little label, you know. So we got Playtime Half Made. I'll tell you the funny story and then I'll shut up. So at the time CBS was going through weird periods as well, like all majors had started to. This is about 1981, 1982. And I went in to see Paul one day. We hadn't finished recording Playtime. We were about halfway through. And he said, look, I've got some news. The label's being sold. And they're not going to put out your record because we won't exist anymore. But he said, Morris Oberstein is the sort of Oberführer at CBS who has bought GTO Records. And he wants to see you, you see. So I said, oh, he said, you know, I don't know what he wants to see you about, but it sounds good because he only wants to see three people from our label, three acts of the, you know, 10 or something like this. I said, okay, wow. And he said, and Morris Oberstein was very well known. Do you know who I'm talking about there? You do, don't you?
I don't, actually.
He was an American guy in London who'd been sent to London to make CBS huge, and he had succeeded. And he was famous for having a big red setter dog. The dog was as famous as he was. So every time you saw Morris Oberstein on the front of Music Week or something, which is our trade paper, you saw the dog. So he said, look, you know, here's your tapes. I've got them out of the library. All you got, it was in Soho Square. He said, oh, I said, CBS is over there, isn't it? In the corner. He goes, yeah, you just walk across the corner. So I walked across there that afternoon and I walked down and said, I've come to see Mr. Oberstein. And she looks at me like kind of laughs. Yeah, who the hell are you? You know, you little twit kind of thing, the receptionist. I said, no, I've actually got an appointment with Mr. Oberstein. She goes, I don't think so, my friend, but let me phone up. So then she put down the phone. She goes, go up, you know, he wants to see you. So I said, okay. So I went into this palatial sort of, what was it like? It was like a sort of Playboy Club type room on the top of the thing in Soho Square, top of the building in Soho Square, very beautiful, elegant room. And there was Morris Oberstein in all his glory with the dog. And there was a dog and a dog. And the dog, yeah. And Morris Oberstein came towards me, put his hand, I shook my hand, and he said, wow, it's great to meet you. It's really, really great to meet you. You're Tot. I kind of went, yeah. He said, well, you know, look, there's a couple of things I need to say to you. And he said, this is, you know, Red or whatever it was. I can't remember the dog's name. This is Red, and he likes you as well. I said, okay. And he said, look, I'm going to show you what I mean. All right. He said, I say no more. Let's just put it on. So he put on my offbeat, on beat, everywhere a beat, beat follows me. And the dog went absolutely bonkers. And along with it, ooh, 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 you see. And then Morris took the needle off and said to the dog, "Hey, Red, this is Tot. That is Tot. That music, that sound is Tot. Look." And he says to me, "Tot, sing offbeat." So I said, "Okay, offbeat, offbeat." The dog was a bang. And, you know, kissing me and everything, you know. So I'm sitting there on the floor. I'm not on the floor. I'm going off beat, on beat, everywhere a beat, beat. You know, it's like a bloody Carry On comedy show, you know. And he just said, "There you go, there you go." He loves it. He said, "Now look, Red loves your record. He loves it. But sadly, I don't."
Oh, shit.
"All is not lost. I'm giving you the record. I'm giving you the record." And there was like, and then he beckoned somebody to come in. There was a lady outside. It was a woman, really weirdly enough, a thin woman. She was holding 6 multi-tracks, which are quite big bloody things, you know. Mm-hmm. And he said, "There's your record, sir. It's yours. No money. You have given Red so much pleasure." I thought, wow, this is like the record business just gets weirder. So she stood there. She gave me, I could barely, you know, she was carrying them. She had like muscles, but I didn't. So I've got these 6 multi-tracks, and I thought, "Let me get out of here, please. Where's the bloody door?" You know? So that was why Playtime didn't come out.
Okay.
Wow. Good place to cut off. We need to do a part 2 if you're up for it.
Yeah,
there's a lot more to talk about. How about 2 weeks from today? Can we do that?
Let's do it. Let's do it.
October 27th at 3:00 Pacific, 11:00 GMT. We'll have you back.
Just remind me on the email.
I will.
And we'll let you know, because we want to talk about this fantastic new album, Frisbee. I mean, I can't stop playing it here. I've got to get a physical copy of my own, but. It's online and it is fantastic, Todd. But we'd like to talk about that.
Yeah, the record.
Yeah. We'd like to talk about that at length. We don't want to do it tonight and cut it off short because it's too good to not talk about.
Sure. Yeah. So, we're up to about 1980.
Yeah. I'm going to remind you where we're at, because there's too much good stuff in there.
We'll talk about Playtime, the inside story, Mary Wilson, and all that good stuff. And then we'll get into
Great. Love to. All right. See you soon. Thank you.
Todd, this has been fantastic. Thank you so much.
Great stories. We're never going to forget these.
See you soon.
Todd, have a great night. We'll be in touch.
Thank you. See you, everybody.
Well, there you have it, David. Holy cow. I mean, that was just, that was Todd Taylor. And my gosh, I was riveted.
It's amazing. You know, you hear this stuff about the record business and you think you've heard it all. And then you find out that a dog was responsible for Todd getting his record back.
Oh, my Lord.
If Red didn't like it, you know, Morris probably would have just thrown it away and not given Todd the rights to it. So
unbelievable stories. And we didn't even get into more of the solo work and the brand new disc Frisbee. So good call on getting him back here in 2 weeks. I think that's going to be fantastic. So, I mean, real quick, let's run down what we got going on, because we've got a lot of things going on, and we hope people subscribe and share and be a part of the Material Issues group on Facebook, because we got a lot of great stuff coming up next week.
We do. We have everything booked through November 17th now. Next week, we have the esteemed authors, editors, Paul Myers and Steve Coulter, who edited the two awesome books on Power Pop, Go All the Way and Go Further. Thank you, Eric. So we'll be talking about that. Thank you, Andy. We'll be talking about that and other things. Of course, Paul, having written books himself and fronted the bands of the Gravelberries and the Paul and John, and Steve being in the Brothers Steve, who have a brand new record out called Dose. So we've got a lot to talk about with them. Then the following week, as you now know, we'll have Todd Taylor back for part 2. Who knows, we might need a part 8, because he's such a great story.
I know.
Following that, on November 3rd, we'll have the head honcho at one of the best reissue labels that I know and that Mark knows, Now Sounds, Mr. Steve Stanley. that he's going to have a new release, a Bo Brummel's huge compilation that has pretty much everything they've ever done. And we'll talk about that and the previous releases. So many amazing records that, if not for Steve, never would have seen the light of day. And so we have a lot to thank him for. On November 10th, we have the irrepressible, the precocious Mr. Robbie Wrist on. I don't even know where to begin to think about what's going to transpire with this. It's going to be outrageous. That
much. Yeah. Put it in your calendar now because it should be a good one.
it'll be a good one and a funny one, and we may end up, having our license revoked afterwards. I mean, he's been in Facebook jail so much, so it's natural that we would go to a real jail after having him on. And then on November 17th, tell us you got this gentleman.
Yeah, we just booked this, and I'm excited about it because I'm a huge fan. George Boyder of the Head Boys, one album, 1979, and it was an awesome album with that great track, "The Shape of Things to Come," and then never heard from again until Pop Detective put out the Lost album, which was the second album a little bit later. But George is such a great guy, and he's just come across some very cool Head Boys memorabilia that was lost and packed away in his garage forever, and he's excited to talk about the Head Boys, their whole really interesting story, how that all came about, and to show us some memorabilia. So I'm looking forward to that. That's November 17th. That's how far out we are booked right now, and we're working on late November and into December already. My gosh, that was episode number 2, my friend. That was exciting, and it just keeps getting better.
It is. Hopefully 50 years from now, when we're still doing this, on episode 2600, we'll be reminiscing about the great times that we've had.
And we like the robotic music.
And, they may invent the pill within the next few years that'll keep us alive that long. So
wouldn't that be something?
As long as we're still here, we're taking it.
David, as always, what a pleasure. Fantastic guest with Todd Taylor. And I'm looking forward to the next 5-6 weeks we got booked already. So have a great night, my friend.
Thank you, Mark. You too, as always. Thank everyone out there for listening. Tell your friends. Really, tell your friends. We've got so much exciting stuff coming up. They won't want to miss it, and neither will you. So we hope to see you again next week and the weeks after.
All right. Have a great night, everybody. Good night.
Good night, everyone.